Lucy's dreaming.
Hi everyone, you're listening to Conversation 3 of the third anthology of Lucid Dreaming, a space for conversation and reverie with moving image makers and artists hosted by author and curator Pamela Cohn. Stay with us for the hour. Our only bribes are spoken word vibes.
Hello dreamers. Welcome to the Lucid Dreaming podcast. I'm Pamela Cohn. I'm so pleased to welcome independent producer, educator, and distributor Karen Chen. Just this past year, Karen began a producing collaboration with Louvator Films, run by Danny Glover, Jocelyn Barnes, Sausan Asfari, and Susan Rockefeller. Their first project together will be an art installation by Oscar-nominated director Ramel Ross, creator of 2018's widely lauded Hale County This Morning, This Evening. Thus far, Karen has produced 10 feature-length independent films, including Circumstance, Stones in the Sun, The Exploding Girl, and The Motel. The focus of my talk with Karen today, however, will be on her groundbreaking distribution work, wherein she, along with an international team, runs Degenerate Films, a company that distributes independent narrative and documentary films from mainland China to audiences in North America. We'll discuss her multifaceted approach to representation, inclusion, and exposure through her innovative distribution initiatives, and discuss her thoughts on acquiring 70 films thus far, an enticing catalog of independent Chinese cinema. Degenerate has partnered with Icarus Films in New York, a 40-year-old company whose catalog is an absolute candy store for cinephiles, representing a collection of over 1,000 titles from the world's most celebrated artists. Icarus has been a leading distributor of documentary films in North America, led by longtime president Jonathan Miller. Founded in 2008, Degenerate's name is taken from global cinema's digitally driven visionary makers, the D Generation. Films are available for theatrical release, educational and home DVD, online AVOD and SVOD, public exhibitions, festival screenings, and all other non-theatrical channels. The company also facilitates co-production relationships between filmmakers in China with global counterparts. Karen also heads a global production services company specializing in socially conscious short format content and directs the Nevada City Film Festival Filmmaker Residency Program. As well, she works as a creative producing instructor for Sundance Institute's CoLab. Karen was curator and producer of the Chinatown Film Project, the inaugural exhibition for the New Museum of Chinese in America in New York, and is the co-creator of the Center for Asian American Media Fellowship, a mentoring program for mid-career Asian American media professionals. Born to Chinese immigrants, Karen grew up in Los Angeles, California. In another iteration of her life, she led one of the U.S.'s leading subprime advisory firms in New York City, later returning to her passion for independent film by focusing on the underdeveloped niche market of Chinese independent film, much of which was completely inaccessible content, even in China. We'll learn the reasons why that is during the next hour, along with so much more. So here we go. Welcome to the Lucid Dreaming podcast, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Let's kind of scroll back a little bit. When films were streaming on Reframe originally, certain independent Chinese films were running on this online streaming service of Reframe, which was under the auspices of Tribeca Film Institute. And it was very interesting for me because I actually, that was my very first writing job in New York, was for Brian Newman for Reframe before it became Tribeca Film Institute's site. And I remember, you know, I'm from Los Angeles as you are. And, you know, when you get to the East Coast, you realize there is this sort of, you know, difference in the way that more independent film, more, let's say, marginalized creative makers sort of take precedence over the more, I don't know, sort of grounded in Hollywood type of model. And you work in both worlds. You actually, you know, straddle both worlds. And I think your producing career speaks to the way in which you take the best of independent cinema and the best of this more, you know, brick and mortar established studio system, if you will, and create and put energy into these passion projects. But if you could talk a little bit, start around 2015 and this this tour in China, this sort of cinema on the edge touring festival in China, with Zhu Rincon and J.P. Sniadecki and all of these people who were realizing that the censorship there was something to be contended with, and realizing how it was being contended with the local filmmakers there. If you could just sort of set up that scenario and talk a little bit about your impressions at that time, about what you felt was really important to bridge the gap, so to speak, in terms of you know, being able to share that work with the rest of the world.
It's a great question, Pamela. I feel like you had an instinct to ask about something that was really unique and extraordinary and very personally driven at the time. And the way I have to set this up is actually to talk a little bit about my family. And so Degenerate Films is a company I started with other partners in 2008. Mm-hmm. And we set out to distribute uncensored films made in mainland China by Chinese filmmakers. So really films about China unmediated by Western view. And if you fast forward to 2015, quite a lot had changed in China, primarily who the president was and how power was centralized and how Xi Jinping approached independent cinema as something that should not exist. So the gray area where these uncensored films had existed in China really started to disappear, I would say starting in 2011, 2012. Mm-hmm. And now in 2020, that gray area is completely gone. It's just this black and white red line that you don't cross. But what was happening was at the end of 2011, my twin sister was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, a very aggressive cancer. And I happened to be home in Los Angeles for the holidays where she lives. And the day before Christmas Eve, we got her diagnosis and my entire life changed overnight. I became a full-time caregiver and she had to go into treatment right away because of how aggressive her cancer was. And every time we finished the treatment, the cancer came back and it came back 5 times. So this ended up being a situation where it was a nonstop marathon of medical treatment, of being a patient advocate, of being a caregiver for about 3 years. And during those 3 years, I, you know, was only able to return to my home, you know, once, let's say for 72 hours. I had to pack everything up, you know, get and just close down my life in New York City, my office, where I lived, you know, my friends. And that included Degenerate Films. I had to figure out how this company could continue without me being present. And took all of my attention, everything I could give. And it's probably the best thing I've done as a human being in my life. But as I was going through it, I do remember thinking how I had to grieve the fact that I couldn't continue my collaborations. I couldn't be there, you know, to work with the Chinese filmmakers that I had supported for so long. You know, mm-hmm. for example, with Zhu Rincon, who is a leading figure in Chinese independent cinema, and who was under quite a bit of pressure, government pressure at the time, I had arranged for him to have an artist residency at the Jacob Burns Center in upstate New York. And, you know, it happened during the long journey of my sister's care. So I was not able to see him or to welcome him or, you know, to be there when he was going through the residency. And he ended up moving to upstate New York after that residency and starting what I would say is a wave of exile of Chinese intellectuals and artists to New York. That's still continuing to this day. So there were just things that I just could not be there for because I was there for my sister. And so after, you know, after five recurrences, after hospice, my sister passed away. And I remember thinking, I need to be able to give back in order to keep going. I need to be able to re-presence myself in these communities that I had left very abruptly. And I looked at what was happening with the independent Chinese scene, and there was a complete shutdown and confiscation of the probably most important independent film festival in China and all of the archives that they held of independent Chinese film. Their archives were raided, the festival was shut down, the festival goers were physically intimidated by the police and by local thugs that were hired by the police. It was really a violent disruption of a very central gathering space for independent film in China. And the festival organizers were arrested, they were detained. And it happened the same day that my sister died. And as a protest, the people who supported the festival created shirts of mourning, of grief. And in China, the color of mourning is white. So they were wearing these white shirts that had my sister's name on it.
Oh, that's
the
beautiful.
Day after she died, because it's the same name as one of the organizers who was arrested. So there was this stunning visual and this very deep resonance and connection I had to what was happening across the world in a community that I had not been able to participate in for 3 years. So after I recovered from just the absolutely exhausting toll of caregiving, I thought about what I wanted to do next. And that's where the idea of Cinema on the Edge came. It was an attempt to support the films that had been released in the 3 years that I had been absent. So Cinema on the Edge is a touring festival of the award winners of this festival that was shut down in Beijing. So we took the award winners of the past 3 years, and we created, a festival in New York City to show these films. And then the series of films started to tour around the world. And that process I can get into later, but it was actually quite difficult because we did run into quite a lot of censorship, as you say, but it was incredibly meaningful to embark on in the grief of losing my sister.
You're essentially American with parents, you know, first generation American. I'd love for you to, you write, there's a very beautiful post which anybody can read about the origin story of Degenerate, but I'd like you to talk about it nonetheless, because there's a way in which you're encountering something that is of you, but is also quite strange and quite foreign. And I'm just wondering if you, as a person with a very particular background, but also as an artist, as a creative person, what you ran into there and why this discovery of the kinds of, you talk about San Juan Li, first of all, this very particular film that you saw that kind of, you know, shocked you, I guess, with its innovative way of storytelling, and also the collaboration of the cinematographers who made this story. And I just, whenever I read something that you wrote or read something about, you know, what Chinese, independent Chinese filmmakers are facing in China then and now, there's kind of this strange reverberation always of what we take so much for granted in Western cinema, what we take so much for granted in the way in which we can collaborate quite freely and where we can create quite freely, in a sense. You know, there's, in some circles, there is an encouragement to really push and push and push. And I noticed throughout your whole career, you align yourself almost automatically with those people of like mind. So I would love for you to just talk about that first trip there, and why, what hit you? What sort of resonances occurred for you there? And the other question I have is, so it's also very hard for me to understand this notion of censorship, this notion that there is a governmental body that is so afraid, they're so terrified of what their own citizenry is feeling and doing and experiencing in their everyday lives. It's for me, it's a very hard thing to wrap my mind around. And I'm just wondering, you know, you had several epiphanies, you had several awakenings, sort of one upon the other. But if you could just retell that sort of lightning moment when you felt like this is something that needs to be shared with the rest of the world, and I need to probably be the person to do it.
Yeah, that's a great question, Pamela. I don't know if I ever thought I should be the person to do it. It's just that nobody else would do it. So I had to be, I ended up being the person that did it because nobody else would. Just to say something about censorship, I think something that I've learned, and I read this in a beautiful op-ed that Ai Weiwei wrote in the New York Times, and I refer to it often, is that censorship works through self-censorship. One thing I learned through my encounters with China is that it's actually to their benefit, it's actually to the benefit of power to be obtuse, to not show you where the line is, because if you don't know where the line is, you will guess and you will participate in censoring yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's a situation that filmmakers have no choice but to participate in right now in China because of the new laws that have passed in the last few years. So censorship works through self-censorship. And there's a version of that in the States too. It's just that the body that is creating these forces is not as visible as the Chinese Communist Party is. And I would say, when I first started going to China, I would say it's actually easier to be able to point at the thing that is blocking you, that is creating these censorship bodies and these rules and these processes. Like, it's easier when that's completely visibilized, because when it's invisibilized, like it is with market forces in the States, it's much harder to blame or to point at what is keeping out certain stories and certain narratives. And that's important because we all share this very human desire to see ourselves on screen, to see ourselves reflected in the narratives that we consume and the narratives that we participate in. So if you are in a situation where you never see yourself reflected, where you can't see yourself on screen, it creates a very strange feeling within you. And perhaps in me, it created an even stronger desire to create that. And it's a large reason why I got into producing. I came into producing from deeply political motivations, and political not like running for office, but political meaning, you know, narrative and filmmaking is a dominant cultural form. It's arguable if cinema still retains that dominance today. You know, maybe that's been ceded to television or to games. But when I started, filmmaking was the dominant narrative form. the dominant cultural medium. And it's still important to see our stories there. It's how Americans or audience members understand the histories of their communities, of their nation. It's how we understand different communities. It's how we sometimes encounter other differences. So I see cinema as a battleground of sorts. And I first focused on Asian American narratives, which very few existed when I started producing. And when I had this encounter with this film, San Yun Lee, it really was another moment where when I saw that film, I realized what I had not seen for the first 30 years of my life. I had not seen views of China unmediated by a Western perspective. I actually sat and thought about everything I had seen about China, and it was always mediated through either American, Canadian, British, and Australian producers or production companies or directors. And that was stunning to me. I was stunned when I realized that, because here I am, someone who is an insider in the film industry and somebody who's very driven to find Chinese American stories, to produce Chinese American stories. And I had never seen anything of China that was unmediated by a Western point of view. So that became my drive. Is I felt that there was an absolute imperative to put these films out in the US. It was a responsibility. I just didn't think that I was the right person to do it. You know, I spent a long time trying to give this idea away to other people. I would encourage them to look at these films that were incredible and to include them in their catalogs, to release them, to think about ways to get them out to audiences. But the more I talked about this idea, I would say nobody was buying it. But also the more I started to attract people who wanted to participate in the idea. So one of the investors I worked with as a producer, he's offered some startup capital if I were to start the company. And another friend of mine who works in advertising offered to contribute the marketing know-how if I were to start the company. And then it, attracted a programmer, attracted a lawyer. So it was an idea that clearly needed to find a home. You know, there is clearly a hunger and a need for these films. So I chose, I would say after a year of trying to make it happen over Skype and email, I realized that China was not that kind of society. It's not an email society. Like, you can get things done over email in the US, at least to a certain point. But in China, it just really isn't. You know, I had to be there. So I went to Beijing for the first time. And the only person I knew was the filmmaker of the one movie that I had seen. He was the only person. And what I did was just email everybody I knew and said, do you know somebody in Beijing? Can you introduce me? Because I knew it was important to be introduced. And when I met that person in Beijing, I would ask them to introduce me, you know, to somebody else that they knew. And very quickly, I would say within a week, I found the heart of the independent film scene in China. And once I met the filmmakers, once I started to talk to them and get to know them and watch more of their work, it was just impossible to turn my back on them. You know, I came back and I knew we had to start the company with whatever we had.
What were you seeing in these Western mediated films, and what were you seeing in these non-mediated films? Not so much as a straight compare contrast, but you talk a lot about this lack of representation from the actual voices themselves. I mean, what does happen when something is mediated? What does happen to us, I think, psychologically when we're watching something mediated versus the more immediate way of storytelling? I mean, you talk about a lot of examples of the way in which, you know, these directors so definitively know the stories they want to tell and how they want to tell them, which looks and feels quite different to what we're used to seeing. If you could talk a little bit about that way in which, like, what is the priority, in a sense, for most independent Chinese filmmakers in terms of dramaturgy, in terms of narrative, in terms of, you know, you talk a little bit about this, you know, Western marriage to Aristotelian structure and the satisfaction of that only because that's what we're taught to be satisfied by, that there needs to be a beginning, middle, and end, and there needs to be some kind of resolution, and there needs to be a certain feeling at the end of it, you know, some kind of, you know, coming away with something that closes the circle, so to speak. Whereas, you know, a lot of Chinese films, I mean, I'm a huge Wang Bing fan, and I've seen some of the other films in your catalog, you know, 70 films so far that are beautifully shot, beautifully edited, and slow enough that you really can go in, if you know what I mean. I think as someone who grew up in Hollywood and was exposed to the Hollywood way of storytelling, this to me was a revelation, number one. And number two, it was actually something I had to get used to. It was almost like I had to retrain my spectator mind into, you know, opening up a little bit. And I'm just wondering, in terms of the way story is told there, how much has to do with the culture itself and also how much has to do with the situation there? And is it one and the same? Somehow, when I'm watching a lot of even fiercely independent films, there is a certain language or through line that allows us to grab onto something. And in the best films, for me, this sense of disorientation and the sense of nothing to grab onto except to just watch and listen is almost like a retraining, in a sense. And I know that these films have shown at MoMA, these films have shown in very sort of high-end cultural institutions, but what about, I would say, the average spectator, the average viewer? How do you sort of brainstorm about getting these films to them, getting those films to those people who are hungry for this, even when they don't realize that they're hungry for it? And maybe you can cite some specific examples of films you saw and how you might market those films, in a sense, to a North American audience. I mean, I think what I'm trying to get you to talk about is this notion of distribution, because even for people who have worked in the industry for a long, long time, there are so many mysteries behind what a distributor is and what a distributor does. And it is disseminating. But how you disseminate that material is also very important. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the brainstorming you had to do with your partners. It's like, here we have this beautiful content. How do we sell it? How do we spin it or market it so that it is appealing to the audience that we really feel, you know, needs it and wants it? Not the MoMA necessarily patron. Do you know what I mean? Not necessarily the sort of high cultural, you know, model of like going to see something to say, well, we saw it there. But more along the lines of disseminating it widely to people who don't get to go to MoMA or LACMA or any of the big museums to see these films, or to the independent cinemas that might play these films.
Yeah, there's. I'll try to address because there's a lot in there.
I know. I just threw a tremendous amount at you. I have a very bad habit of doing that, but
no, it's great. It's all because it is all tied together. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that as storytellers, one of, or maybe the most important thing we have to offer is our point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So we seek stories told by very specific points of view. And I think that we all seek honesty. We can recognize honesty when it confronts us or when we encounter it. So that's what I look for. I look for an authenticity. I look for an honesty. I look for something I haven't seen before. I look for a point of view that I didn't know existed. And even to this day, I would say that the films that I acquire are the ones that create a sense of true wonder in me. Wonder, almost to the point of when I'm watching it or after I watch it, I think to myself, how does this film exist? Where did it come from? Who made it? You know, it just opens up all this curiosity in me. And I still regularly encounter these films from Chinese filmmakers. And it's always just a very joyful process, you know. So given that, we started our company with a mission. And I would say one side of the mission was to bring these unmediated, you know, points of view, these films made about China by Chinese filmmakers in China. Very simple. We wanted uncensored. We wanted to bring these stories to American audiences. But the other half of our mission was we wanted to bring revenue from American distribution sources to those filmmakers because they didn't have the opportunity to make any revenue in China. So we wanted to be a revenue source. So that's an equally important part of our mission. And in order to do that, you have to understand how the distribution marketplace works. And when I started as an Asian American producer, there were two features I had to self-distribute because we couldn't get a distributor to take it on. You know, that situation has changed drastically since when I started. But back then, nobody had any appetite for these films. So I learned how distribution worked. And I knew that there was one market that was almost all profit margin. And that's the educational market that is selling to cultural institutions and universities. And that profit margin has shrunk over the last 20 years, but it still exists. It still remains a profitable space of distribution and exhibition for, especially for nonfiction films. So understanding that we were committed to returning revenue and also understanding that a theatrical release is a loss leader, you're almost guaranteed to lose money on it. And understanding that, you know, the educational market was a profit-making space, that's what we focused on. So it's part of the reason why we went with Amazon through Reframe as our original partner. When Amazon started their manufacture on demand DVD service, they called it CreateSpace back then. Now it's morphed into Amazon Direct Video, I believe, or Amazon Video Direct. And back then, CreateSpace took a huge chunk of the profit, but Reframe through Tribeca and Brian Newman had created a special deal where Amazon only took 20%. So it was a very favorable deal, and we were able to sell educational DVDs on that platform too. So in order to do that, we also had to create scholarship around these films, and we would invite critics and curators and academics to write about our films. We had to create profile for these films, and you do that through festivals, through awards. So there's a certain awareness. You have to generate public awareness. And for studios, if they have the money, they do it through billboards and through, you know, the trailers and advertisements. And for us, we had to be creative. And we were very specific about which market we were targeting. So in the beginning, it was just us and Amazon. And it took a few years for a place like MoMA to pay attention to us. And there was only a very short window, I would say like a 3-year window, that we had films showing at MoMA. And that's because starting at a certain point around 2015 with the Cinema on the Edge series, the censorship that was up until then only felt in China started to be felt in the US. And now that is common knowledge. You have columns in the New York Times talking about Tim Cook, you know, and Apple TV's directive to never deal with China, you know, because they understand what they risk there. And that is, so the long reach of censorship has, you know, from the Chinese government has come to the States, where it's not necessarily that, a lot of people will say that the US industries defer, you know, on Chinese issues because of the financing or the money that can come from China. And I would say in the film business, it's not actually because of the financing, it's actually because of access. What companies and corporations, what they are really after is access, and it's access to the Chinese market, or it's access to Chinese art, you know, whatever access that is. It's the access being threatened that creates the spaces for our films in the US to close. So since 2015, it's actually gotten harder and harder to distribute the films. And in the beginning, all our films, you know, they're up on Amazon. Netflix used to show most of our films.
Really?
I mean, that's hard to believe now.
Wow.
Yes, Netflix used to show most of our films. I mean, we are equal opportunity. We will show these films wherever people will take them. But then, you know, the industry shifted on the US side at the same time that the politics and the power shifted on the Chinese side. So in that 2012 to 2015 transition, what was happening on the US side was this shift towards originals, this shift towards episodic, and that... Mm. You can mark that around 2014, 2015. So the spaces where our films could show online, as you say, to anybody, you know, those started to close and not exist. And that created a situation where we realized that we had to create our own platform. And I give a lot of credit to Jonathan Miller at Icarus Films for generating a collective of small distributors, of independent distributors, which is now started with 6, is now up to 25.
Wow.
And we power our own SVOD exhibition platform called Ovid.tv.
Right.
Because there has to be a space online that people can, you know, subscribe $6 a month to and watch as many of these films as they want. And now we're up to, between the 25 distributors, we're up to 1,000 titles on the platform. You know, and still working on growing the audience. But we, you know, bob and weave however we can as the industry changes, as it's doing at warp speed. And we also have to bob and weave however we can as the power changes in China.
Well, there is this also, the notion too that it can work another way, and that is to allow others, you know, you mentioned something about these Chinese makers that if they can, if they have the opportunity, they go ahead and they leave. They leave China because they want to be somewhere else to make work. How does that... Not all of them, but I mean, you know, this is, we kind of I don't know, there's this notion of being able to work globally. You know, this is also, especially now, this sort of imperative in a way, you know, that now that we can work globally, we will try to work globally. But when you think about, let's say, the next, okay, COVID aside, and, you know, what is the next, I don't know, like 5 to 10 years look like in terms of growing the catalog, in terms of also the importance of that archive that you're building, that sort of solid foundation of a library, if you will, of all of these disparate voices, you know, being housed under one roof, so to speak. For me, that is the most moving thing about the way in which you and your partners have modeled the company. I mean, I don't see it. What I do see is maybe the line of dialogue opening up and a line of understanding opening up. But in terms of the next few years, let's say, how do you see things transforming? Do you sense another groundswell of a political shift? Do you sense that this is maybe the worst it's going to get? Or, you know, I'm just trying to figure out or want to know from you what it feels like there, what it feels like in China right now, when you talk to young filmmakers, what their state of mind is, what their artistic visions are all about in terms of what resonates with you as not as just a distributor and a producer and all of those things you do professionally, but as a spectator, you know, as a cinema lover, that, you know, no other films about that place can tell us except from what comes within.
Yeah, I would say I actually am more worried about the US side.
Yeah.
I am more worried about what is happening to our options as viewers in the US. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that I am for a environment or a world where there's multiplicity. And that's really hard to have when there's just constant consolidation happening. And we've saw a tidal wave of consolidation in the film business, and that's only continuing. You know, I read this, I'm not good at predicting the future, so I read articles about people who are trying to predict the future. And I read this article, this trade article, that interviewed people at the end of 2019. And of course, no one predicted the pandemic, but there were 7 lawyers interviewed for that piece, and they all predicted more consolidation, every single one. So I have to listen to that is the reality. So what that tells me is, one, I'm really grateful that Ovid exists, because at the least we have a space. We have this tiny corner, you know, carved out on the internet where our films can exist and where anybody can, you know, can sign up for a free trial and watch them, honestly. And we also still have other vehicles in which to make revenue, so we can send revenue back to the filmmakers. So as long as those mechanisms exist, then I feel a little bit more confident, you know, to build other structures. And what I'm looking at right now in the States is building a different kind of structure for exhibition, because we can see that the theatrical model of exhibition is really difficult to sustain. There's a huge amount of overhead, the brick and mortar, they have not been able to survive through the pandemic, right? They've had to lay off most of their people. They've had to close. If studios don't put out product, traditional cinemas cannot open. So what exists right now between a traditional movie theater and your Netflix queue? What's in between? So there's this space in between those two experiences that we haven't built any structures for. So that's what I'm interested in. Can we create more micro cinemas? Can we create a new kind of viewing experience where you don't have to spend all this money to go see a movie, but you also don't just have to stay at home by yourself and watch, you know, Netflix or Hulu or whatever it is. So I think there's so many possibilities because so few exist right now. And in China, what I can say is that the work continues. There is no shortage of creativity there. And I heard this talk once by an economist, Paul Krugman, and he said the real truth of China's rise out of poverty is not any economic policies or what you might attribute it to. The real secret behind it is the energy of the Chinese people. And I completely agree with him. I mean, there is so much work ethic and entrepreneurial energy and creativity in China. It outpaces the US by far. And it's actually what I take as my inspiration as an American producer. I am inspired by the creativity of what I see on the Chinese side. And it also makes me feel like, oh, well, we're actually quite lazy over here and we're not doing enough, you know, but they're working against obstruction after obstruction after obstruction and figuring ways around that. So in a way, yes, that's really tough and that's very, very challenging. And everybody has to make their own decisions, whether they participate in the system, whether they leave and find a space outside of the system, what to do for their families. I don't judge any kind of personal or artistic choice that's made by Chinese filmmakers, you know, because I don't live there. You know, I'm not faced with the same risks and the same choices that they have to make. But regardless of what choice they make, they always find a way to continue to make work. And the work continues to be much more innovative than what I see out of the States. And of course, there's terrific, extraordinary, innovative work coming out of the US. But there is, like I said, when the forces that cause you to create work in a certain way, when those forces are invisible, it's actually harder to go around them. And in China, when they're more visible, then it's actually easier to just, if you want, reject those forces altogether and just be like, I'm going to just go over here in my own corner and I'm going to make this movie that I have no idea if anybody's going to see, you know? So if you knew that you were making a film that could not go into a movie theater, that could not be distributed in your home country, that nobody could see, how would that change your creative process? It would absolutely change the way that you write, the way that you cast your film, the way that you edit it. Maybe you'll make an 8-hour film like Wang Bing did, you know? So that freedom, that creative freedom that I have found in abundance in Chinese cinema has, as you say, Pamela, retrained my brain. My brain has changed from watching hundreds of these films to the point where it's actually quite difficult now for me to watch a conventional US documentary. I almost cannot make it through the 90-minute experience because there's just too much. There's the graphics, there's the title cards, there's the voiceover narration, there's the talking heads, there's the, this constant construction, right, of a narrative. And there's not always as much risk, you know, as you want to find. That's not always, like, there's always films that stand out, like Time by Garrett Bradley is a US film that I think is extraordinary. It's a film that you watch and you think, how does this film exist, right? That's the experience I have watching Chinese films. And those are the films that I want to get out into the world. And those are the filmmakers that I want to help return revenue to so they can keep making their work.
Mm-hmm. The projects that you're working on now in the US, I know you're working with Louvertour, you know, have a new partnership with them and moving forward in your producing career. I mean, maybe you already answered this question, but I mean, what in terms of, there's a huge misconception, of course, about what a producer is and what a producer does. And there are many iterations and various talents in which a producer can bring something to a project. I mean, the money, yes, is an important, you know, aspect. But I mean, if you're working as a creative producer, if you're working from the ground level and really partnering with a maker to support him or her and to sort of constantly clear the path for him or her, because according to you, yes, and I agree with you, a lot of North American filmmakers and European, sorry to say this, maybe I shouldn't, maybe I'll ask Luke to edit this out, but European filmmakers as well live in this sort of really weird fantasy world of how they are going to be supported. You know, there's a real, I don't even know what the word is, but there's a dependency that's a bit worrisome. And as I'm listening to you talk, you can see these compromises, you know, that have been made. I think from sheer aversion to risk. And I hear you saying that risk-taking, that no holds barred risk-taking is sort of the future of cinema. So to close, you know, the conversation, I'm wondering if you would talk about, you know, what, now that your brain has been rearranged, what kind of projects are you hungry for to produce in North America or Europe or, you know, wherever you happen to be, that all of your years working with Chinese filmmakers has informed in terms of the way your priorities have changed, in terms of the way who you choose to work with, you know, how that model operates, that's quite different from maybe previous models. I mean, you've produced, you know, a lot of independent work, but I'm just curious to know how that has, that profession of yours or that aspect of your profession has changed, has enabled you to maybe look beyond, you know, the purview that you might have had before several years ago, and how, you know, what excites you about that in terms of working with, continuing to work with Chinese makers for certain, but also non-Chinese filmmakers where, mm-hmm. or a maker yeah. wherever they happen to be.
Yeah, I think that you said it really well, Pamela. You said that the future of cinema lies in the risk-taking. And I could not agree more that that is the way that the language of cinema is going to evolve, is going to leap forward, is by people who are willing to take those risks. And I don't necessarily judge the filmmakers who are working in a more conventional mm-hmm. narrative structure, because that structure is very, very much driven by financing. So and the financing is driven by distribution. So, you know, there's a interweaving that happens that maybe creates a bit of a creative trap for filmmakers. In order to get the financing, they must tell the stories in this way. So the very bold souls who are able to break out of that and try something different, whether or not they fail, those are the storytellers that I'm attracted to. And also in the States, there remains so many stories that have yet to be told about so many communities. Exactly. You know, for example, there's a film that I'm really interested in that other very competent producers are already taken forward, but I've reached out to them and I said, I will support whatever I can do, please call on me, because it's one of the first films that will feature a Hmong community. And the Hmong communities in the US are, you know, this is a community that is perhaps stateless, you know, that has lived under conflict, that fought on the US side, you know, but are yet quite invisibilized in the States. Another thing is I started a filmmaker residency specifically for Native and Chinese American producers and filmmakers. And I started it in a gold rush town in Northern California, where this town was, you know, exists on Native land and was, you know, a large part of the infrastructure in America was built by Chinese immigrants. That story does not exist almost anywhere. It's quite hard. It doesn't even exist in that town. So we need to re-present these stories. We need to rewrite or to write American history. If I have downtime, I watch as much film or content as I can by Native filmmakers. Because, and I think that that's something we all have a responsibility to do. You know, that is the community that perhaps has been the most invisibilized from American cinema. You know, so there's still so many stories, great stories, romances, action adventure, comedies, you know, things that will appeal to all audiences and different audiences. And that's, there's just so much work, interesting work to be done. And I want to work, I'm very much drawn to working on those stories with people who have the same appetite, you know, for risk and for adventure in the filmmaking process.
Thank you so much, Karen. It was such a pleasure listening to you and getting to speak to you.
That's all for this episode. We'll return next week in conversation with Takashi Makino. Lucid Dreaming is a production of Lono Studio, hosted by Pamela Cohn. And if this is your first time listening, do hit that subscribe button and leave us a nice review. Goodbye, dreamers.